you learn in the last 30 minutes? Something new?
Yes.
What did you learn?
Precision.
Fear of rejection. What else? Rivers. What else? Little anger ticks. Interesting. Yes. What else? Control. Stress. Efficiency. Singing. Could be in the singing stroke. How about the singing and the vacuuming and the nude stroke? Travis, I didn't need to see that in my mind. I appreciate you pointing that out, though. I'm going to need a lobotomy to get the vision out of my head.
Show up in karaoke.
Karaoke nuts. That would be all
no.
Japan. Thanks for calling Japan nuts. I don't know if that trait is true. Is it true?
No.
What's your experience?
Not karaoke.
Not karaoke? So we're getting into unproven territory, which I think is really fun and exciting. And so as you go through, let us know and email us and let us know what these you find very, very true. Again, these are metaphors for a personality profile. So here's the way I'm going to categorize this. I will tell you a secret. Is that for years I've been looking at the more complicated handling books. And I've looked at them and I've read them. And I've fallen asleep reading them. And I thought to myself, okay, they build me as the world's greatest expert. I really should learn this stuff. And it's complicated. And I thought to myself, I hardly ever see this, but I need to know it. Okay, if I'm digging through criminal handling samples, I see this. And quite frankly, it was confusing. Has anybody had that experience reading advanced books and reading trait stacking and reading there's this little obscure tick on the lower part of this and this means that and this person killed 14 people when they were 8 and their mother raped them and blah, 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 blah. And then you go, but how does that relate to all that backstory? And it's confusing. So because of its confusion and because of the fact that we didn't actually see a lot of these traits, I have resisted putting together an advanced format until I felt I had clarity using it functionally and teaching. So that was why it's been 8 or 10 years since we've done this. Now, if you visit with me or Kurt or any of our faculty, you'll see us stack stuff all the time. And you'll see us go, well, you see this, and this, and that equals that. And you'll go, well, Bart, where's that in your book? And I go, oh, it's not in the book because I haven't put it in the book yet. And it's not intuition, it's a pattern. So what I did now is I thought, well, okay, I'm going to go look through the, you know, books on trait stacking. Some are as old as the 1920s, you know, some of the German books in the 20s. Some are translations. And they're all very good, but they're very confusing. And there's books I've read that just page after page of confusion. What I found was the most confusing part is that people have different words for the same stroke. So they'll have a different word for directness as they have for efficiency. And then you get stuck. Okay? It's like learning a new language. You're cruising along and you're speaking a language and then you see a word you don't understand. And you want to skip past it because you sort of want to get the gist of the paragraph. And then you realize if you miss that word, that could be critical to understanding it. And so the section on stacking traits is completely dependent on your full comprehension of the primary traits. You follow that? Mm-hmm. Repeat that. The understanding ability to stack traits on top of each other and understand the model I'm going to give you is completely dependent on your full comprehension and comfort with the primary traits. And there's two primary traits. The basic stuff, which are stuff in the Grapho deck, the stuff we went over this morning, the little quiz we did, the things that if you've read a book or if you've played the Grapho deck or you've done the bar trick and Hail Man, those are the basic traits. This section is called advanced primary traits. And so the word basic really means primary. It means if there is one piece of ink that equates to a certain personality trait. And usually it's accurate. There are obviously exceptions to most of these. But luckily, this science is such a way that they've categorized, man, a T-bar here means a whole cluster of personality traits. And I still am amazed that someone came up with this, and it's as accurate as it is, and if you stack them together. So this section is to go over primary traits that you may not have seen. Now, if you've seen most of these, consider yourself really well-read. Because if you're familiar with most of the ones I'm going to show you, then you've probably read lots of books, you've listened to CDs over and over and over, and you've heard things like the word worry loop or repression, even though it wasn't in the textbook. So consider yourself very well ready for the next section. But if you don't know these things, it's exceptionally hard to start stacking the traits in a logical sequence. And that's where I got stuck. And so what we did the few months was preparing this manual, and the seminar was saying, oh my gosh, what are all these primary traits these other books are referencing that we don't have a word for? Or are we calling it directness when they're calling it efficiency? Are they calling it evasiveness when we're calling it secretiveness? So some of the things we're going to see, like the word emotional responsiveness, we can also call what?
Expressive.
DE writer. E plus writer. Like it's the same words a couple of times. And so I've combined some of those vocabulary words. So this is probably the most analytical part of our seminar. I don't think it's complicated. In fact, it's kind of exciting because you're going to see things and you're going to go, wow, I didn't know what that meant. I've always wondered what that meant. If you see it and you know it, good. Check off the fact, hey, I know it. This is really good. Okay? Now, we did this in alphabetical order just to make it easier, but I'll stop and deviate because I'm going to show you patterns that you may not pick on your own. The first one is benevolence and goodwill, and it's simply a stroke. And so I want to illustrate the most important point about these advanced traits is that many times there's a specific meaning and they call this benevolence. And when I say they, these aren't necessarily mine. These are accumulation of a lot of other books. Okay? Benevolence and goodwill basically are two fairly positive traits. Anybody disagree with that? Probably. What does benevolence mean? Anyone?
See the best in people.
Generosity, see the best in people. Okay, goodwill, obviously, emotive and or providing service of people. It seems to be a positive trait, however you look at it, right? There seems to be a pattern with a cluster of positive traits and a cluster of negative. And the pattern is there tends to be much more curves and nice shapes among the nice traits. And then you see sort of anger and tics and sarcasm and angles. So what you're going to find is, and I want to make it clustered because I want to make it easy for you. It seems to be clustered in the shapes, which are triangles and angles and dashes, are much more hostile rather than the shapes that are much more round. I was 19, I was in a seminar with a lady named Sheryl Solomon. Does anybody know who this person is? She wrote a book, or a couple of books. She was really popular in the 80s. And so was Billy Joel. And Blondie was very popular in the 80s too. But I digress. Sheryl Solomon was talking about shapes of children's handwriting. And what she said was, there's certain shapes that your children make. And she based her entire theory of graphology on these four shapes. The first shape is a squiggly, a triangle, a circle, square. Does anybody having a background in another form of psychology have any ideas, in theory, if we're going to be huge, holistic, gestalt therapists, what this would mean as a generality? Now, excuse me for going general for a second, because we're going to go general, we're going to go abstract, and we're going to pull that down to finite strokes and handwriting. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's what we're going to do. Now, if this was your first time ever in a handwriting seminar, I wouldn't do this because I don't want you to sound abstract when you give an analysis. Not at all. I want you to sound very specific. But all these advanced strokes, not all, most of them are sort of formed based on a couple of theories. Upper zone, middle zone, lower zone, right? What's upper zone? Lower zone.
Physical.
Middle zone.
Mundane.
Right. Basic philosophy. And if you know that philosophy, if you see a really big loop in the upper zone, it has a different meaning than if that is in the lower zone, right?
Right.
Just location. So this is the same sort of theory. And this theory has to do with shape. So, different shapes. Now, if a child is 4 years old, and they doodle all the time, and they always doodle in angles, is there any sort of meaning you could ascertain about that general personality of the child?
Very intelligent.
Angry? Perhaps.
Quick
thinker, intelligence. What does that correlate with handwriting?
The M's,
right? Perfect correlation with the letter M's. Well, the M's were correlated with the shape, actually. We memorize the M, meaning analytical, but actually it's the shape that's more important. The M's are just where it is. Now, if a child had this sort of angular shapes all the time, yeah, they would be quick-thinking, analytical. Would that person be more benevolent? More benevolent? Is that Spanish? Portuguese sort of mixed between French and Spanish. Would they be more kind? Would they be more gentle on the playground or more aggressive?
Aggressive.
I think they'd be more aggressive. Again, we're generalities here, okay? But what about a child that was sort of like rounded and everything was curvy and it's just really fluffy, right?
Sweeter.
Now that's sort of, in my opinion, if you use Eastern philosophy, a little bit of yin and yang. Mm-hmm. You've got a little masculine, a little bit feminine. Mm-hmm. Now, let's not be mean here, because there's a lot of women and men who are sensitive in the room. But what would you consider a masculine quality versus a feminine quality in the spiritual or the Eastern sense? You know, not just phallic and not phallic, like, you know, Freudian or the what was that movie that just came out with Tom Cruise? Not Mission Impossible. Tom Cruise.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Da Vinci Code. Da Vinci Code.
That's Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. The stand-up comic says, well, I saw the Da Vinci Code. All I understood that everything is either a penis or a vagina. That was her joke. It was like, every symbolism in the entire world was seated in those two categories. So, no, that's not what we're talking about. However, there is some symbolism there in yin and yang. So, what would be some masculine qualities that you would consider masculine if you were referring to an animal or even a car? What would be masculine? Or an airplane?
Aggression.
Speed. Fast. Powerful. Speed. Control. Toughness, right? Mm-hmm. What else?
Powerful. Impatience,
okay? Now we're getting the women versus men. I know what happened. So we can go there. It's fine. Because yeah. You know what? We're actually both masculine and feminine tendencies. I have a very balanced masculine and feminine. In fact, one guy did actually accuse me of being gay. Like, on the first, she's like, I swear you're gay. And I kiss me. She goes, no, you're gay. Trying to prove it. I wasn't. Fine, you kiss me. Is that proving it? I consider that a compliment to my metrosexuality. Okay, I consider that a compliment to me. Because I'm very balanced, masculine and feminine. Some men, let's say in Alabama, for example, may not have a lot of femininity in them. In fact, they may find that repelling and or offensive. So they're going to go overly aggressive, overly non-expressive. Let's talk about femininity for a minute. What would be a typical emotion of a feminine character?
Nurturing.
What else?
Gentle.
Kind. Passive. Interesting. Obviously not a woman trait, but probably more feminine than, say, a masculine category.
Yeah.
Come on, women, it's your moment to just make us look stupid. Just split out.
Shopping.
Shopping.
Emotionally expressive.
I think emotionally expressive is definitely more feminine than masculine in a generality.
Yeah.
Okay, you could have both.
Kindness.
Okay. I think if you're looking as an employee and you're saying, I want to get a team player, someone that works well in groups, would you get a more feminine personality or more masculine personality?
Feminine
tends to be more teamwork and benevolence and goodwill, okay? Which in some corporations, you often, and this is probably true even today in the 21st century, you have a masculine leader and you've got a lot of feminine support staff, whether it's men or women. Okay, because sometimes the leader needs to be more aggressive, they need to be more pioneering, they need to make harsher decisions, and sometimes they're not the kindest people. You know, there's a lot of really talented people that have yes men around them just to keep them from embarrassing themselves. Okay?
Wow. Yes,
heart. I don't know what she's laughing. No idea. Anyway, the reason I go into this sort of long-winded speech on shapes and children and everything is because these shapes tend to form a lot of letters that we make. They form the margins. They form the overall look. If you're referring to Gestalt, how many of you read books on Gestalt handwriting analysis? Okay, Clara Roman, you happen to have a book in your hand on Clara Roman, very famous Gestalt analyst. And they're very useful. And they do based on this theory. However, if you don't combine this theory with the more analytical detail, it can sound hokey-pokey.
Yeah.
Hokey-pokey?
The name is turning yourself off.
Just hokey. Just sort of obscure. You know, I've met astrologists that have really impressed me. And I've met some that also don't impress me at all. You're going to be sick. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
I see that you're getting older in your future. You know, that doesn't impress me much, you know? So I want details. And so it's useful to have this. And the reason I bring it up in a more advanced seminar is because the structure of these shapes make a big difference. In general, the triangles relate to the more aggressive personality. The triangles, sharp angles. If you're thinking of weapons, would you want sharp weapons to hurt someone or soft round weapons? Okay. Even verbal daggers, right? Verbal sarcasm, verbally sharp, punctured, sharp. It's in our language as well as in our handwriting. This is much more gentle, and this is referred to as security. Square, for some reason, is the security-minded. Again, the big round M. This is a correlation to the letter M is probably the easiest way to look at this, okay? So these shapes sort of have a symbolism. Now, let's go look at some of the strokes, which they've categorized as certain shapes. Now, I don't really need to memorize which is benevolence and goodwill and which is called friendly, because it sort of has the same shape. And I'm going to go, oh, I see the shape. That's going to be one of those clusters of really positive, sweet, feminine, or masculine. And by the way, I don't consider masculine negative or feminine positive. Although I'm definitely leaning toward feminine more positive because I'm straight and I swear I am. I've lived in West Hollywood too long. I'm ambisexual. Okay. Bluff. This is one that is a word that came from Milton Bunker, if you've read graphical analysis. Does anybody know what graphical analysis is versus handwriting analysis or graphology? This is actually on your final certification test.
Yeah.
Okay, Jerry knows. Anyone else? Jerry, you want to explain?
It's a coined, trademarked term, which is the same thing that you're teaching.
Well, it's not exactly the same thing. It is a trademark term from a guy named Milton Bunker who basically leveraged his books to someone that loaned him money in the mid-50s. And this is from Dr. Walker. He lost all his money and they took over the patent and the literary works of this guy named Milton Bunker. They then created a school called the International Graphical Analysis Society, which was active and by far the most successful one in America from about the mid-60s to about the mid-80s. At some point it went bankrupt in the mid-90s. The material within that school is very valid and normally very, very good. The challenge with that school is the business model on top of it created a patent which said you can't use that word unless you're part of their school. Even if you graduated from their school, they could kick you out if you didn't pay dues. Yeah. It became very political. And most people, including Phyllis Mattingly, who is on our course, our master's course, they just decided it was more complicated than this word. The reason we brought up Milton Bunker in the first place is this is not in my original books, but it's called bluff. It's pretty common knowledge in the community. It's a very heavy descender, almost like the opposite of sarcasm. It's a heavy downstroke. It sort of looks like a club stroke. I haven't used it a lot during my life, the word bluff. I haven't used it in my analysis, but I want you to know it. I'm going to give you all the traits that I think you might see and you might know. This trait, if it's in the upper zone, becomes positiveness, like in the letter T, that's not sarcastic. It tends to be people that are not sarcastic. So they'll say, well, absolutely, I'm going to win this hand. I do have two aces, and you believe them. Right? So it's sort of a bluff, but it's in the upper zone of T bar. So it's a similar stroke. What is sarcasm, essentially? Here's an example of sarcasm. I can't think of one. Isn't that shocking?
Like, this Bart is a really great seminar.
Isn't that a danger? Yes, sir.
Bart always thinks well on his feet.
Bart always thinks well on his feet.
That's sarcasm.
Yeah.
What's the difference
difference between that and clubbing?
I believe clubbing is not supposed to be a downstroke. It's sort of like in a T or the end of a letter. But again, there's not that much difference. It is a heavy stroke, but it's heavy to the point of it's distractingly heavy. Mm-hmm. Bluff is sort of like the opposite of sarcasm. Here's what sarcasm is. Sarcasm basically is saying one thing and meaning another. Or saying one thing and having dual meanings. You know, you look great in that dress. You don't know what I mean. Is it, am I being facetious and am I not? You know, it's different than an insultment like, oh, you look a lot thinner than you did last time I saw you. That's sort of a mixed compliment and an insult. You know, so that's not really sarcasm, but sort of a hidden insult. So sarcasm is dual meaning, the opposite. So a bluff would be no sarcastic at all, which is a very firm ending versus a pointed ending. So you have this ability to say things in a way that people believe you. So it's also called positiveness, and we'll see it in the P section there, okay? And again, you can ask me my opinion on the reason this wasn't included is I didn't use it much in my analysis. It's sort of confusing with determination. It's sort of confused with the bluff stroke. It's confusing, okay?
And bluffing is cruelty. I mean, not bluffing, but the bluff stroke is cruelty.
Cruelty. Bluffing, not so much. But bluffing also is not incredibly honest either.
No.
So, I mean, you've got that fine line there. But I don't think they're going to beat you because you have two aces and not a king. Okay? Broad-minded. I think you've probably seen this before. What is narrow-minded? What is that called? How does that look?
It's narrow.
Interesting. So the opposite of that is the wide openness. Now, which shape does this look like of those shapes?
Circles,
feminine, open, listening, okay? Broad-minded. So this person's more friendly and more open and more of a team player with the more oval shapes in there. Cautious. This is, by definition, the tail of the letter just stringing out. Not necessarily the name, but anywhere in the writing. And I think that the general theory would be that the person's writing and they're not lifting their pen because they're not quite sure they're finished yet. So they're thinking, I'm just gonna make sure before I let go. I'm gonna make everything sure. Okay. And I have seen this, and it has been accurate. Cautious.
I have a tendency to do that. I take a lot of notes because I'm in college, and when I come to the end of a line and there's not room enough to put another word there, sometimes I'll make that ending longer. But it's not being cautious, it's filling up the space.
Filling up the space. Now that goes with margins. Have you studied margins at all? Do you have any idea what it means if you fill up every bit of the margin? You don't know? No boundaries. You know, it's interesting, and I know it's in the certification course, and it's definitely in the handout section, but it's such a useful gestalt thought process, meaning if they actually have no boundaries on their paper, you're going to have less interpersonal boundaries. I have found that to be more accurate relating to someone's sexuality and sexual prowess than the wise. And I've never said that in the seminar before. But those boundaries around the margin, if they fill in every space, they're so much more open-minded about anything to do, and not just sexually, but no boundaries. I wouldn't say poor ethics, but it's just not the same stringentness as someone with a huge boundaries. There's a huge clear boundaries. And of course, boundaries can move either way, okay?
When I write, I use the notebook paper. I have the white margin here, but I usually go out right to the end of the paper on the right side.
So I wish I had a slide of the margins here, but I definitely know them in the handouts. And if you want to, we can go back tomorrow and visit them again if you feel like you want to cover them.
Would you see that in criminal handwriting, having no boundaries?
Oh, I think for sure. In fact, one of the first handwriting samples I used in the 101 book with that real crazy guy, Thomas Kane. I think you've all seen it there. There's just no boundary at all, you know.
Except the one from Arizona.
The one from Arizona.
Oh,
State
my
State.
God. Yeah. Isn't
that great?
Oh, it was great.
I mean, until he gets out of prison, he's coming to find me. What are the odds he's ever going to see my CDs? Come on. These guys are kidnapping me. Clannishness. Now, this is another word that we might not have used, but I think you know. What is a small tight loop in the lower zone? Selectivity, right? Selectivity. Good. What's the word clan mean? Clannishness, clan of the cave bear. Small group, small selected private group. So someone that's clannish would be someone that's not very open to more than one or two or three people.
And they tend to have a similarity.
Send up someone. Well, obviously, you choose people similarity. Yes, ma'am.
Does that have a connection to the jealousy loop, do you think?
You know, it does look like a jealousy loop, except it's in a different zone. Okay? But if you are connected to one or two people, you might have a fear of losing those one or two people. I wouldn't consider a fear except for a fear of being exposed to more than one people. So I think if someone is really has a fear of intimacy or a fear of opening up, I think they are scared at some level. I don't know if it relates to jealousy, but jealousy is a fear of losing by definition. So I don't know if that's a connection. Don, you have something?
Mark, that's one of the traits of homosexuality.
Here's what Don said. Let me address this. Don said that might be one of the traits of someone who might be homosexual. In Milton Bunker's books, which were written in the 50s, he outlined that this is common among homosexuals. Portuguese for gay, right? So let me ask you, I happen to live in Hollywood, West Hollywood, probably, besides San Francisco, a high percentage of gay people. I do not see this trait very often in handwriting. Now, so why would someone, Milton Bunker in the 50s, assume that this trait might have something to do with your sexual preference? Yes, ma'am.
Because back in the 50s, it wasn't acceptable.
Back in the 50s, being gay wasn't acceptable. And what consequence might happen if everybody knew?
Okay, not past too
clear. So it's not exactly open, but thank God we're not where we were 50 years ago. So in my opinion, and you know maybe Don disagrees with me, I think this is not a sign of gayness. I think it's a sign of fear of being emotionally exposed or revealing intimacy, which was a high correlation with being gay in the 50s, which is why Milton Bunker does that. Again, the reason we have to update our books and update our definitions is this was not a cause but a symptom of something else. This trait I don't think means gay. I think it means symptom of, hey, if I'm gay, people will mean this. Okay. So again, I don't want to make anyone wrong or any books wrong, but I think it's a correlation. Don, please.
Yeah, Bart, remember I said that's one of the signs,
right.
One of the indicators that somebody might be gay. The clannishness, that is a group, a clan group.
Sure.
And that's why I put it in mind.
No, I agree. I agree with you. And I think the explanation says, yeah, you're probably true. It is one of the many factors that we could say, oh, there's a clue there. Again, being in West Hollywood may be totally different than being in, you know, Nebraska. Or Texas.
Hey,
or
it's rampant in Nebraska. I live here.
Condescension. You know, I just rarely see this trait. But what does it look like as far as another trait which we're familiar with? Condescension essentially is a strong angle going down. Looks like domineering, right? Or dominant. What is the hard angular upstroke? What is that stroke? It's resentment, the Roman. So it's the same stroke of resentment, Roman, same stroke as dominant. I think it's the same stroke. I don't see it much, but it looks like resentment to me. So if I see these hard angles throughout the writing, I'm going to think, oh, resentment, condescension, maybe domineering. Negative. Unless you're in leadership. This is tricky. I've never had anyone agree with me that they're stingy. Seriously, that they don't want to agree to it. Their wife will agree to it, or their husband will agree to it, but it's just such a negative term. But it's true that it's like an accordion. If the handwriting is compressed, they tend to be more conservative, stingy, tight with money. According the other way, they tend to be more generous.
I have an elaboration on that.
I would like to hear your elaboration on that.
Wouldn't you think you would find that to be more the case with smaller writing than larger? You know, because smaller writing may tend to be a little more frivolous anyway.
Yes, but it would be harder to find the width because the trait itself is not the size of the middle zone, it's the size of the between the letters and the compressedness. Now, this example is exaggerated so you understand the process, but not necessarily. You could have an extrovert that is emotionally repressed. So I agree with you that, yeah, it would be more common, but also be harder to see. Yeah, I have seen handwriting that just looks like someone just smushed it. Okay? Conservatism. Now, we've seen this one. This is on the graphic, too many irons in the fire. It's when the writing goes into other writing. Okay? This is often called confusion. Sometimes they get too many things going. Some people call this tough making a decision. They've also used the metaphor of people with like dual personalities having a hard time making decisions. There's a lot of symptoms, there's a lot of reasons why someone has the symptom of hard time making a decision. But getting confused would be too many things going on. So if your writing is really large, or your loops are very large, and they tangle, there's lack of organization. And that's what you'll find in this writing, is a lack of organization. Like somebody's closet with things just all over the place. It would be harder to decipher which is which.
That's a little bit ostentatious too, isn't it?
Not so much. Ostentatious would have big entry strokes and big exit strokes and strokes that say, hey, look at me. The only thing that's really that would be the long T bars, which is enthusiasm, and the Y's. Okay. This is the challenge about this. And it's funny, I've had people look at the Grapho deck, especially people that aren't interested, and go, I'm not in here. My handwriting's nowhere in the Grapho deck. I'm like, there's 50 cards. Your handwriting's in there somewhere. Nope. Because they're looking at that going, my hand doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
They're not looking at the letter going, oh, the Y is this link. They're looking at the general structure of it going, oh, does it match? Well, of course your handwriting's not in there, bozo. There's 50 trades. What's the odds of your handwriting being my cards? Okay. Decisiveness and positiveness. Now, I should have put a T on here. Blunt ending, like the bluffness, with a heavy ending on the T. Opposite of sarcasm. That is decisiveness or positiveness. Again, I don't use this trait much, but it's useful to know because it's sort of, you know, if somebody can bluff or not, or it's the opposite of sarcasm. So they're going to pretend they know the answer when they don't. Again, firmness, decisiveness, probably a sister trait to the club stroke, which would be a violent externalization of that, but this would probably be a very positive way to handle it. Because I think decisiveness would be a good thing, as well as positiveness. Okay. Again, looking at the end strokes there, not the rest of the writing.
Are you looking at the end stroke or the fact of the where it comes to the baseline, that point, as opposed to a curved stroke?
Just the fact that the handwriting ends in a decisive ink spot. The person wrote and they went, I'm finished. Opposed to wrote and went, I don't know if I should be finished yet. Okay, let's go. Okay, let me know where we are.
It doesn't fit.
Defiance. I used to have a lot of this. I have less of it now because I don't like speeding tickets and...
Yeah.
I don't like trouble. I'd rather covertly get away with it than to force it. So defiance would be a large capital K, or any other letter that's a little bit bigger. Okay. We've talked about this a couple times, efficiency and direct to the point. Writing that leaves out extra ink on the end. What is ego? Carissa.
It's your vision of yourself.
It's your vision of yourself. I think we can do better than that. Keep going. Go ahead. Give me a sample of ego.
I don't know.
You don't know. Come on, you know. Come on. What's an example of ego?
You're impressed
with yourself. Maybe. That could be vanity. But we're talking about the concept of ego, not like the negative symptom of ego.
Someone who's completely comfortable with themselves and confident, but with a touch of vanity.
Well, now you're talking about big ego. Which is what we're doing here, large ego. But first let's talk about ego in the Freudian sense, and then we'll define it to large or small. Identity. Who you are. What is it? What is ego, id?
It's self-esteem.
How you wish others to view you.
It's your conscious self versus unconscious self. It's a sense of who you are, and how much space you take up, and maybe how important you are to the world, right? A sense of your significance in the world. Is that fair? Okay. So is ego good or bad?
It is.
It depends. It's also your morality, okay? I wouldn't say it's ethics as much as like the sense of yourself. People with no ego, what's probably a negative symptom of having no ego?
No
self-esteem, perhaps, right? Would you get walked on if you had no ego?
No.
Yeah.
Most likely. Would you ever write a book if you had no ego?
No.
Would you ever lead a company?
No.
You know? Would you ever have a relationship that was anywhere equal?
No.
So, we need some ego, or we don't have a sense of space. Okay. What about the negative symptoms of an ego that's too large?
Yeah, inflated importance.
So very.
Inflated sense of importance. So, I mean, what's a sense of importance would be good. What's inflated? I mean, where's that line?
They think they can
not
do a lot
on anyone else. And
not relying, pushing other people around.
Okay. Thinking you're the only one that's right.
Righteousness or stubbornness or arrogance, right?
The difference between your image of yourself and other
and reality.
You.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting. So a person with a really large ego might have a distorted image of who they are versus what the rest of the world sees them as. Now, someone who is insignificant, let's say they're 18 years old, they want to be a famous athlete or rock star. Does that big ego help them create and manifest that bigger-than-life image, or does it hurt them?
It helps them.
Good.
But what if someday they really become Robbie Williams or Bono? Now, their self-image does match reality. So is it really a false image, or is it real?
It's false,
and they created it.
Perseverance, they could create it.
So I'm just saying it's not always bad to have one or the other. It depends on the role you're playing. If you want to marry this person, it might be challenging for you. If you want to go see his rock and roll band, you're going to have a great time. Okay? If this is you, realize that you better be in the spotlight and you better have people around you that can handle that sort of arrogance, because that's the negative side of having a big ego. Is ego, or is a big ego or healthy ego, part of self-esteem?
Yes.
Yes.
It is. So question, if you're looking at somebody's handwriting and you want to know self-image, what must you look at besides the T-bar?
Signature.
The size or capital letters. Okay? That's new information to some of you. Which is why you can't only look at the T-bar. What if somebody had a really, really, really tiny signature, but a high cross on their T? What does that mean?
I didn't hear the question, I'm sorry.
Okay. What if they have a really tiny signature, tiny initial capitals, low ego, but their T-bar's right on top?
They expect to be successful through hard work.
Well, I would say they're not overinflated, they're just confident, they really don't care too much what others see, how others view them.
I think there's more to it. Let's explore that, because this is what you have to do now.
Say
you have to take contradicting traits.
It seems like they'd be more realistic about.
I think realistic would be good. Yes.
But a signature, they don't necessarily want to be in the spotlight.
Right.
But they feel okay about themselves and about the way that they view themselves.
So they're, would you consider them humble?
Yes.
Yeah. Possibly that.
Would they complete their projects?
Yes.
Assuming everything else equal, we're not talking about why. Okay. So possibly.
No, they just don't need to be in the spotlight.
What about content?
Content. God, isn't that the ancient Buddhist question?
No, people who have the large capital letters of big ego, nothing's enough. They can be $1 million man, but they have to be $1 billion man.
I think that's a very astute observation.
Very.
So if it's a smaller signature, smaller capital letters, then they would have more contentment with their
maybe.
But Buddhism teaches that one of the purposes of us on the planet is to overcome your ego.
Yes.
And a lot of the Eastern philosophies, and Ken Wilber says the battle with the ego is the essence to finding contentment and happiness. And if you can get outside your ego, you can get outside of fear and jealousy. You can even get outside of death, because ego is part of this body, and if you believe in another lifetime, then you would then not have any fear of death, because it's all ego, it's about me, me, me. So very astute, my little Buddhist.
Would it also mean that they don't have a need for attention?
I think that's true. I think large ego goes along with need to be recognized and need to be space. However, I use the word space. I'm not sure if I ever clarified this properly. If you go into somebody's office and somebody says, "Hi, how are you?" They come, they shake your hand, they lean back, they put their feet on their desk. Big ego or small ego?
Big,
because they're really comfortable in the space, right? Opposed to, "Hi, how are you? Great, I'm going to sit in the corner here and only I'll talk if I'm spoken to." That's not a very healthy ego, and probably not conducive to getting what you want. So I think the healthier the middle ego is probably the better choice. But again, it depends on your outcome. So I agree with you. Let's take the opposite case. Let's say you have a very big ego like this person here, and the T-bar is very, very low.
They're going to blame false bravado.
False bravado. But they do have bravado. And they might be charming, and they might play rock and roll well, and they might look very confident and even sexy to you women that like that sort of thing.
But inside, they're insecure.
They don't believe in themselves. But can you really say they don't believe in themselves?
They don't believe it in themselves.
They don't believe the facade.
They don't believe the facade, but can they act as it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Could they win the gold medal?
Yes. Sure.
Could they be a boxing champion?
Yeah.
Why? Because ego is a huge motivator to succeed. And sometimes you're right, in the end they're not happy.
They don't think they deserve it.
Okay. But would it be fair to say the person with a huge ego has a low self-image? I'm going to say it's not fair. I'm saying you have a dichotomy with your self-esteem. And I'm going to want to go into a conversation of separating the two, saying, here's the deal. Your ego, your confidence, your contextual confidence is strong. What is contextual versus context versus, what's the other word for? Content. So like context, meaning that if I'm playing soccer in the World Cup, and I'm, let's say, this is me, I'm a soccer player, I'm in the World Cup, I'm playing. Am I confident on the soccer field?
Yes.
Absolutely. Contextually, I have high confidence. Self-esteem wise, could it be low, and could that still be accurate?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Relationship wise, they could be the most insecure man on the planet. Oh my God, who are you talking to? Who's that? Self-esteem wise. And then your self-image would come out in other situations. So you can have confidence in certain context and still have a low self-image. And you'll see that by the ego, as well as the personal pronoun I, which is the third layer of our self-esteem in our conversation. Self-esteem is probably the most important concept that you'll ever learn in the field of self-development and personal development. And it's probably the most important thing for people learning how to manifest what they want in life. So it becomes more complicated. I wish that I had time to explain this to everyone who reads my basic books, but they don't always do that. They go, okay, the T-bar high, boom, it's done. It is more complicated than that. I raised my T-bar, I think it helped, and there's more to it. And by the way, I've never told somebody they have low goals and they agree with me. It's like people, when you say negative stuff, they just deny it. You know, you're shallow thinking, you're closed-minded, and you have low goals. You don't get much agreement there, even though we may be right. Or they go, well, I have very high goals. I've got a master's degree from some school. Well, great, but you know what? There was never any risk involved if you had a low T-bar. You've always been good at school. You made straight without trying, and that's the most risk-averse thing you can do is stay in school. They don't want to hear that, and it's insulting, and it discredits the fact that they did have a master's degree. But the fact is, they never took big risks, and that has to do with the T-bar. Big egos will also take big risks, not just self-image. Don't just be getting complicated, but it's fun. Okay. Ego small, okay? Great, same thing. Big, the ego related to the size of the middle zone. This girl's name is Ann Toms. A and T, very small, in correlation to the middle zone, okay? You're right, I prefer a high T-bar and a moderate size signature. But I don't want a signature too small, because that person's gonna get walked on and not gonna have good personal boundaries. And especially in relationships, you have to have boundaries. What's right for me, what's wrong for me, what I accept, what I don't. And people let those boundaries slide all the time and end up in relationships they shouldn't be in. And it has to do with the ego and sense of boundaries, and it goes back to self-esteem.